Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Uh-uh, we got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble, 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 trouble.
Two, four, Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
You're listening to Radio Basics Toronto, and on today's show, the ever prolific, the always on point, Mumia Abu-Jamal, certainly the world's most well-known political prisoner today, may be returning to death row for the crime the world over knows him not to have committed. We'll be playing his popular radio commentaries throughout the show today, along with a few of the many songs that have been written for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Protests are planned for tomorrow in Toronto and all across North America. Also hosting with me tonight is Kirti. How you doing, sister?
Good. How are you going?
All right. So what do you got for us tonight?
Well, I have a feature interview with an activist and lawyer from the Tamil community. His name is Abhimanyu. He's going to be talking about Bill C-49. It's been causing a lot of ruckus, so just want to shed some light on that.
For sure, for sure. We got him at the top of the hour, actually right after the commercial break at 8:15. In the meantime, Radio Basics, all power to the people. Free Mumia and all political prisoners. Keep the dial locked to 105.5 FM here on Radio Basics. We're going to play some tunes attributed to Mumia Abu-Jamal, some social commentaries. We'll be back. Check it out.
I'm a team player, I could be a leader and a follower. Nug to a solid, to the bread and a hollow too. And if you ask me my politic, I'm a savior. If they're digging, popping, well, I'm the opposite. Raised as a rebel in the outlaw communities and villages. I seen the illest, I seen the power of the people in fucked up conditions. Snatch diggings out of them jails, I ain't kidding. Since a little month I can, in the lion's den. I got my eye on them, fire upon them. Happy 56 to Mumia Abu-Jamal. Stand tall on that side of the wall, cause on this side, if you don't get high, it's gonna be a homicide. Soon as it's dark outside, now the only thing that's gonna save us is revolution. One nation under a rule, yeah.
Where would hip-hop be without the founders of the crown? See, there is no future when you disregard the past. The pioneer forces that brought forth the culture, before there was a double XL or the soft. It was formed in the streets of New York and the Bronx. And a crate full of records on the block. Yeah. B-boys on the cardboard spinning like tops.
False freedom. There's a certain sense in the minds of millions in the aftermath of the U.S. presidential election that we've reached a promised land. The imagery and oratory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is invoked to suggest that his dream, as articulated in his epic I Have a Dream speech, has been realized. There's a deep sense that freedom is here, as we all live in a post-racial America. Or do we? To be sure, we're all on the brink of history, for this has never happened before. But there was a time, quite a while ago, that similar feelings swept the especially black hearts, that a new day was breaking, and the old ways had fallen away, when freedom was as real as rain. I speak of the Reconstruction era, when the nation extended civil rights to millions of black men, not to women, notably, and scores of black people took office in state and federal legislatures and began a wave of progressive legislation to better the abominable living conditions of millions, black and white alike. But Reconstruction was short-lived due to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, the betrayal of black freedmen by the federal government, and the campaign of white terrorism against black people and Republicans, which converged to reassert white supremacy. The Supreme Court also played a pivotal role in the Slaughterhouse Cases of 1873, which, despite the clear language of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, supported states' rights over federal constitutional rights, and thus signaled to the South that its denial of rights and segregation of blacks wouldn't offend them. The hopes and freedoms of millions were dashed for more than a century so that the lie of white supremacy could prevail. At the end of the Civil War, when slavery was formally abolished, black people were so joyous that they changed their names to represent this newfound freedom to define themselves. They organized their own churches. They opened businesses and schools. They ran for local and national offices. They sat on juries, and they married in droves. Within a generation, all of these freedoms were washed away by law, custom, and a vicious reign of terrorism. What this history revealed is that freedom can be ephemeral. It matters not what is written in constitutions, nor the rhetoric or promises of politicians. It matters what people fight for. It matters what social movements struggle for. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
He said it, brothers and sisters, that was Mumia Abu-Jamal. For those of you not familiar with the case and trial of Mumia Abu-Jamal, author, journalist, jailhouse lawyer, he was arrested and sentenced to death for the December 1981 killing of a police officer, the evidence of which overwhelmingly suggests his innocence. We all too often hear of evidence emerging years or decades later exonerating inmates of crimes they were convicted of. In fact, this was the case this last week in Canada with the acquittal of Ivan Henry in British Columbia, a man who served 27 years behind bars for acts of sexual violence committed against 8 women, but who was acquitted on October 28th of this year by the BC Court of Appeal after the judge recognized 3 critical errors made in the original trial. But the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, however, like so many other prisoners of the American government's war on black and brown, vocal opponents of American imperialism, especially past Black Panther Party members, is not that of evidence merely emerging later to suggest his innocence. The evidence of his innocence, and in fact the evidence that all the legal proceedings against him have been anything but just, show that the trial of Mumia has been nothing less than politically charged, making him a political prisoner, no different than Nelson Mandela was when he was imprisoned as a terrorist by the apartheid South African regime. Tomorrow, November 9th, 2010, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals of Pennsylvania will be ruling as to whether the death penalty should be reinstated in Mumia's case. Mumia's death penalty was stayed back in the mid-1990s due to, no, in small part, the massive worldwide mobilizations against his execution. And now the penalty may be reinstated for a crime the world knows Mumia did not commit. What an irony it would be if the black face of U.S. imperialism gets away with silencing what previous white presidents were never able to do, despite how much they all wanted Mumia dead. Tomorrow in Toronto and all across North America, there are protests occurring against the Third Circuit Court of Appeals trial. The demand, stop the execution of Mumia. In Toronto, this demonstration will be held outside the U.S. consulate at 360 University Avenue between Queen and Dundas. Attend if you can. If you need more information, check out the website or our website, basicsnews.ca, or just Google his name, Mumia Abu-Jamal, to learn more about his case. And now let's listen to some more of Mumia's incisive social commentaries from prisonradio.org, Radio Basics. We'll be back in a few minutes after a commercial break with Abby Manu talking about Bill C-49 introduced into Parliament a couple weeks ago. Check it out.
The war against ourselves. We often think, when we dare to do so, of the Iraq War as a war over there against those people, folks other than us. Depending on our political perspective, it is either a good war or an evil war. But no matter our political, ideological perspective, time will determine whether it isn't a war against us all as well. That's because for those tens of thousands who survive, who are neither killed nor maimed, they will return to the U.S. with their minds twisted by an orgy of violence that will not easily be left over there. It is worthless to listen to any major political figures to speak of this war, for they're speaking with flowery words about unreality, with buzz phrases like support our troops, they're fighting for our freedoms, and other such nonsense. Several recent books, written not by brass, but by low-level non-commissioned officers, tells a story that will never make it to CNN, to the networks, or to the daily press. That's because these reports, written by line soldiers, are striking in their absence of political jargon and the illusions usually presented as war reporting. Do you remember reports about the notorious Iraqi house raids, ostensibly as searches for weapons? Paul Rykoff, a platoon leader of National Guardsmen, describes how he and his men broke down doors, tied up all the men, and ransacked people's homes. Of these raids, Rykoff wrote in his book, Chasing Ghosts, Failures and Facades in Iraq, these, quote, were nasty business. Anybody who enjoyed them was sick. Sometimes I felt like I was a member of the Brown Shirts in Nazi Germany. Rykoff writes about men in his platoon stealing money from these Iraqi families, something he describes as not uncommon. In the corporate media's reflexive war promotion and its overt message of support the troops, who knows what they're supporting? No politician, right or left, will describe them as modern-day Nazis, riding roughshod over the Iraqi people and indeed creating a resistance that didn't exist at the time of U.S. invasion. That's how far politics is from the truth, a truth dripping out of soldiers who are unafraid of self-description. In the years to come, when people trickle home, they will carry these nightmares into their work lives and also into their personal lives. They will be cops, prison guards, politicians, merchants, teachers, and yes, journalists. Within them will be these silent demons who will not rest in Iraq. American society was deeply impacted by the return of Vietnam veterans, and not for the better. We have yet to see the ripples from the war wash against the shores of this land. We will find that the blood of war and the perversities of occupation will splash against us all. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Your community radio,
CHRY.
105.5. Here, I'm gonna just, you know, have a feature interview about Bill C-49. I got Abhimanyu Singham on the line. Hi, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
Okay, awesome. Can you just tell us quickly about the work that you're doing in the community right now?
Sure. My name is Abhimanyu Singham, as you mentioned, and I do a bit of human rights work. I do a lot of work with immigrants, especially the Tamil community. I've been working on several government legislations, including Bill C-49, and I'm also closely working with the refugees that landed in Canada on August 13th.
Okay, thank you for giving us that brief. So you're also doing some work around Bill C-49, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, so what is this bill about, and what does it have to do with people smuggling? Because that's what I keep on hearing, smuggling.
Right. Well, the concern that many of us, including mainstream activists, have is that it has nothing much to do with human smuggling, although it is framed as a bill to prevent human smugglers from abusing Canada's immigration system. It misses the mark completely, and it is specifically meant to target the smugglers, but I believe, and most of the activists and people that are concerned about this act believe that it is, you know, actually a bill that is aimed at attacking refugee rights and said so. The objective, as the government says, is basically to curtail human smuggling and to punish human smugglers. But what in the process it does is basically to victimize the refugees even more, and you know, it creates a two-tier system that that contributes to the derogation of refugee rights and therefore violates Canada's Charter of Rights as well as Canada's international human rights obligations.
What do you mean exactly by a two-tiered system? Could you elaborate upon that?
Sure, yeah. Well, basically, what I mean, in the past, Canada has done is, you know, the people who have landed here as refugees have been treated as refugees and then, you know, have been, you know, processed under the IRPA, the Refugee Protection Act. Mm-hmm. What this bill does is basically based on how you arrive in Canada. If you happen to arrive in a, in Canada on a boat, for instance, like the MV Sunsea, which they say was organized by human smugglers,
yeah.
Then you could be you could be called a designated refugee, which would mean that you could potentially be in incarceration or detention for more than a year without any due process. And, you know, basically you'll be not given the same rights as any other refugee. For instance, you will not be able to apply for a landed permit for 5 years. You will not be able to travel to another country for 5 years. You know, you will not be able to sponsor your family for 5 years. So it basically creates a system where people, just because of the mode of transportation that they chose to arrive in Canada,
yeah.
will not have the same rights as another person.
Now, Abby, so let's suppose, I'm sure maybe some of our listeners are asking themselves, you know, why didn't these refugees, if they had legitimate cases, mm-hmm. why didn't they take the normal avenues to become refugees? Now, you know, sure. to provide a bit of context, there was the civil war in Sri Lanka that
right.
saw the massacre and culling
right.
of tens of thousands of Tamils. It was recognized across the world to be a gross human rights situation. Gross violations of human rights and you know,
mm-hmm.
crimes against humanity by the Sri Lankan state. So
right.
why didn't one may ask, why didn't the Tamil refugees just apply through normal channels?
Sure, I mean the normal channels as they are available to Tamil refugees, basically to get themselves smuggled out of Sri Lanka by, you know, some means, because it's an island state, and therefore the only way that they can get out of Sri Lanka, if not had not been accepted as refugees in Sri Lanka, which in most cases will not ever happen.
Yeah.
So the only chances that they have is basically to get themselves smuggled out of Sri Lanka to a third country, such as Thailand or Malaysia, and then to, you know, register with the UNHCR, and to see if the UNHCR will then process the application, wait mm-hmm. until a third country will accept them as refugees, and then wait another few more years to see if they will be accepted by another country, and then, you know, therefore go to another country. This happens
yeah.
in some cases, but in most cases, like the case of refugees in Thailand and in Malaysia, where refugees who had gone there to these countries to, you know, ask for asylum with UNHCR, have then been arrested by the police in Thailand and Malaysia,
yeah.
and have been sent back to Sri Lanka to face the same, you know, persecution. So
yeah.
they continue to face, you know, persecution even in the third country that they have chosen to take asylum. So their situation is basically they need to get out of even the third country that they are in as soon as they can.
Yeah.
And so therefore they choose to seek any means of getting out there. And,
escape.
And the fact that, exactly. escape from the situation. The fact is, Canada has not done enough to accept these people. I mean, if the Canadian government would have actually initiated a program such as the one that recently was talked about by the Canadian Town Congress, where they could actually put in a refugee processing center in a South Asian Southeast Asian country to fast track these applicants, we wouldn't have had you know, a situation where 492 people will put their lives at risk, get on a rickety boat, and you know, and sail across the ocean to get you. We
yeah.
wouldn't have, you know, done that. I mean, people wouldn't have done that.
For the purpose of illustration, this is kind of like, to use an oversighted example, but something that everybody can catch. This is like supposing the, you know, Jews in Hitler's concentration camps could have applied for refugee status to Canada.
Absolutely,
something
yeah. I mean,
ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. And if you would have, you know, they would have waited for a country like Canada, in which case even after coming to Canada they were sent back. That was a different story. Even you know, in the present context, it doesn't work. I mean, this is a country that has Sri Lanka is a country that has, you know, just recently killed tens of thousands of people, have, you know, basically blocked off all international community from, you know, entering into the country, to, you know, to even act as witnesses to the war, and then to provide any sort of assistance to the people that have suffered the war. And, you know, this is the same country that continues to persecute the people that, you know, that are the witnesses for these war crimes and crimes against humanity. So there's no way that Sri Lankan government would have allowed these people to get out, or another country to actually process the application. So therefore, these people are not left with much option.
So I had a question. Like, can you elaborate a bit more on how exactly refugee rights are being attacked?
Well, the Bill C-49, for all intents and purposes, is not a bill that is aimed at actually attacking the smugglers and punishing the smugglers. It is actually attacking the refugee rights instead. And then basically, as I mentioned earlier, like it creates a two-tier system. Therefore, you could be designated based on how you arrive in Canada. And then what it does is basically, if you happen to be in the designated category, then you could be detained for up to a maximum of 1 year without any detention review, which would include, you know, if in this case, for instance, MV Sunsi would, you know, or a similar boat would come from another part of the world, they could be detained for a year, including children. And then, in several cases, including the Australian cases, where the Australian Human Rights Commission has clearly, reported that these kind of detentions have been, have caused extensive damage to children as they were detained in these detention centers. And in addition to that, like what most of us are concerned about is that it clearly violates Canada's Charter of Rights and also the Canada's international human rights obligations. Basically, any person that is here in Canada and who had been accepted as refugees should be able to then apply to receive landed permanent resident status and then to sponsor or reunite with their family, which is basically the core of societal structure. What this bill does is basically take away their right to reunify with their family, and then in that process basically is then going to force the family to take some sort of illegal means to get here, which would again undermine the whole objective or said objective of the bill.
In fact, it seems like the bill is so punitive that it may prevent refugees from coming in the first place.
They're saying that it is going to be punitive in the sense that it's going to prevent the refugees. But in a case where, for instance, like take the example of Vietnamese refugees or the Tamil refugees in this case from MV Sunsi, how many of these people who are fleeing war and who are fleeing death would actually first off know the laws of Canada, to know that it is something that is going to put them at risk for and in jail for 1 year, or would care actually, because these are people that are actually fleeing death. So this is not actually helping to actually curtail the influx of refugees. It is actually what it is doing is basically is preventing a class of refugees from entering into Canada, and therefore is basically preventing people. Obviously, Canada has an obligation to uphold international human rights, and then it basically slowly takes away Canada's role in that sense as well.
Can you maybe quickly, really quickly talk about what exactly the situation in Sri Lanka is like for Tamils, quickly?
Well,
what's provoking them to actually leave?
Right. So it is very interesting when government bodies and UNHCR and others suggest that because the war, supposed war, has ended, supposedly. The things have changed for Tamils, and then somehow all of a sudden overnight things have conditions have improved human rights wise and otherwise. What has happened is basically, yes, the military aggression has come to a stop, because you know the rebellion has been crushed. But what it has done is basically it has taken away all the structures that were there to resist oppression and resist human rights violations. So what and it was also in the process chased away all the international observers and most of the human rights observers. So what has happened
hold
is
on, one second. So are you saying that there's still no international bodies there? Like there's nobody who actually were able to enter afterwards? Like
let me just tell you a small story about how one of the incidents that were reported in the newspaper was about how the ICRC, the International Committee of Red Cross, was delivering or issuing the tractor trailers that are used for agriculture purposes in the Vani areas. The ICRC, and through its head in Sri Lanka, head of operations in Sri Lanka, was at an event where they were actually distributing these tractor trailers for the most needy, the people that had already lost everything in the Vani area. You know, Sri Lankan government official went there, basically gave another list to the ICRC official, said, read this list, and those were going to be the recipients of the tractor trailers that were actually given by international community. The ICRC person was left with no other option but to go behind the stage and cry. This was documented. The pictures were all out in the media, and people have seen it. So this is a situation that's happening to a international community, I mean, well-known international organization, and to a non-Tamil, non-Sri Lankan person. And then you can put yourself in the Tamil's shoe, who are basically a person who is in the Vani, with very limited knowledge of English, with very limited contact with the outside world, and with very limited infrastructure to resist or protest. They are basically trampling. They're basically being trampled upon. There's nobody to question about it, and there's nobody to report on it. And you know, if you look at it, like from another perspective, if you're looking at about 492 people are actually fleeing this country, there must be something wrong with this country. I mean, if everything is perfect, why is the Sri Lankan government still continuing to object to an internationally observed an investigation into the war crimes? Why is the Sri Lankan government still protesting about the presence of international organizations in the Vani? So these are questions that people
either, right?
What's that?
The media does not have access to the
media has
right?
very limited access, and that is in the form of guided tours.
And
the media has come out and openly said that. I was speaking to a very well-known Canadian journalist from the National Post a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that when he was approached by the Sri Lankan government to visit these places, he asked them straightforward, would I have access to these people, or would I be taken in a guided tour? And they said there will be somebody with you, and he said no, I'm not going in that sense. So therefore, there's no. I mean, obviously, the media can go, but obviously, it will be on a guided tour.
So basically, none of that is being addressed by the Canadian government, right? As to why these people are fleeing or anything, it's kind of like ignored altogether, right?
So basically, the question that the Tamil community and I think most of the activists and people that are aware of the situation are posting out, this basically. The Canadian government needs to put its resources into two things. Firstly, to obviously combat human smuggling. Nobody's questioning their legitimate right to do so, and that's something that the Canadian government has the right to do, and we are obviously encouraging the fact that they should be doing that. But secondly, what we also need to look at is how are the refugees' rights are going to be protected, and that they're not going to be victimized even further because they've already been victimized by the country that they're fleeing from. Mm-hmm. Secondly, they are being victimized by the human smugglers that are, you know, obviously, you know, making money as these people are coming out. That's and right. Thirdly, what's happening is the Canadian government is victimizing them by, you know, enacting such legislations, right? So, the Canadian government needs to look at how they can actually, protect the refugees' rights without actually, compromising on the safety and security of this country. Thirdly, what mm-hmm. we need to do is basically the Canadian government need to put more resources and more effort into finding out why these people are leaving and mm-hmm. act to prevent things like that happening. Because absolutely. If they would have been actually, makes a lot of people very angry and very it hurts a lot of people, because when hundreds of thousands of people in Canada were protesting the war as it was happening, Canada kept quiet. Yes, Canada That's would have stepped up and then said, okay, enough is enough, stop the war, these people wouldn't have had to flee.
So the question is, Abhimanyu, while these are just claims that most definitely we need to fight for, we need to be advocating amongst the Canadian people, the more incisive question is can we actually legitimately expect this from the Canadian government, given it is what it is? And let me expand on what I mean by mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Canada has not been neutral or completely indifferent to the conflict in Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. The armed combatant organization to which most Tamil people look to, the Liberation mm-hmm. Tigers of Tamil-Elam, was declared a terrorist organization by the Canadian government, and mm-hmm. my understanding is that was a legitimate a belligerent according mm-hmm. to international law. And Canada, as with the case in Sri Lanka, has made such interventions in many places in the world where there are people fighting against regimes of state terror, gross mm-hmm. violations of human rights, breaching international law, committing war crimes,
right.
To name a few: Colombia, Israel, Philippines, India, and of course Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. And in all of these cases, what we see is the Canadian government has, not only not taking a position on the side of justice and human rights, but in fact has come down on the side of state terror, mm-hmm. sometimes even providing active diplomatic and military, and sometimes even, aid in mm-hmm. favor of these states. Free trade agreements, with Israel, right. Colombia, healthy diplomatic relations with the Philippines, including trade agreements, another type of human trafficking altogether, living caregivers mm-hmm. coming from Philippines. Mm-hmm. So given that the Canadian state at this level is at this time is by no means neutral, in fact is highly, highly partial to right. and in favor of such criminal regimes, really, and I'm not being, bombastic. I mean, by mm-hmm. by norms of international law, these are criminal regimes. Mm-hmm. Can we actually expect that the Canadian government would so, easily relent on the claims of human rights? Particularly, for example, when the refugees came on the MV Sunsea, mm-hmm. we saw that the discourse that was immediately whipped up was one of being suspicious of potential terrorists on the boats.
Right. No, you're right. Absolutely. And pointing out that the Canadian government doesn't have any legitimate interest in acting on it, and will not act unless they heard it loud and clear from all sorts of community members, all sections mm-hmm. of the society. And that's what we are basically hoping that will happen, because this is again human rights in Sri Lanka is one thing. What is happening is has its own charter of rights and freedoms. What this bill is doing is basically not only is it violating Canada's international human rights obligation, what it's also doing is violating its own charter of rights and freedom, and therefore basically undermining the bottom line, the basic infrastructure that Canada has to protect its own yeah. citizens. So that is what is more concerning, because this is not anymore about a government keeping quiet as another government kills and rapes and massacres people. What this is doing is basically taking away the rights of people in Canada, and mm-hmm. slowly, therefore, it is it's derogating our own rights. So therefore, it is everybody's rights. I mean, obviously, you know, anybody that's concerned about their right in Canada needs to step up, and then they need to fight this. So that's why this is a different issue. This is altogether not about Sri Lanka. It's not about Vietnam. It's not about Philippines. It's not about Colombia. It's about Canada and its own charter rights and freedoms. And that's why we are hoping that, you know, just a couple of days ago, the Global Mail came up with a story about how some of these organizations that are so-called supporters of the bill have either, backtracked on their support or are, they have the names and that's pretty much what they have. They, you know, the government has been using these names as evidence of widespread support for this bill. And, the Global Mail's article sort of, really was able to put a, context to that. And I think it is very important that, in addition to the mainstream organizations that have been speaking out about this bill, people from all sorts of, all sorts of communities, all sections of the society, all kind of activists need to, have a say on this. And that's why I think I'm really in support of the CCRs and Amnesty International and other
CCRs,
organizations.
CCRs, Canadian Council for Refugees.
Council for Refugees, sorry, yes.
Are there any action items that are attached, or is there anything that, the community
sure,
is doing?
Sure, no, I mean, what we are basically doing is, right now, it's in the Parliament, it's had its second reading, it'll then be referred to the committee for review and amendments, and then and back into the House. Right. Okay. What we are asking basically is, people to speak to their local MPs, go talk to them, tell your concern about how this supposed human smuggling prevention act is actually violating their charter rights. How this is creating a two class of refugees. How that it is, it proposes mandatory detention, which would potentially put even children under detention for one or more years, and also that it denies designated refugees the right to apply for permanent residency and then to sponsor their family, and then to say clearly and then very vociferously that this bill has nothing to do with preventing human smuggling.
Absolutely.
And we urge them, general public, organizations to either come out with statements or speak to the MPs, and then make your voice loud and clear and be heard.
And they can get more information from websites like Canadian Council for Refugees.
That's right. They can go to ccrweb.ca. They can go to Amnesty International. Amnesty Canada website.
Okay.
There are several websites that have come over.
And, basicsnews.ca will most definitely have some feature analyses coming up in our next issue of the paper as well. Abhi Manyu, thank you so much for being on the line with us tonight.
We have to
cut it at that point. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate your time.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Radio Basics, we are dedicating our show tonight to Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll be playing some more tracks attributed to that brother, and some more of his social commentaries later, and some more information on the rally that will be happening tomorrow night in Toronto, and coinciding with rallies all across North America and even the world to oppose reinstating the death penalty in that brother's case. Radio Basics, I'm here. Steve, Kirti, we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Foster, and you're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM.
It's a short set of ads for today. We got a track for you from some local Tamil MCs here in Toronto. Maybe Kirti can tell us a thing or two about them.
Yeah, for sure. Basically, like a lot of people know, like in 2009, there were a series of protests. So these youths basically got together and, thought that, it's really important to, educate more people about the struggle and so on. So they got together and, used music as a tool to express themselves, how they feel, their outlook on the whole struggle and so on. It's pretty good. They started off and, looking forward to more tracks from their end. They're called Rising Records Entertainment, and this track is called Rise Up.
Rise Up from MCJ, Phoenix, and Vice featuring Shigare. Is that right?
That's right.
All right. Check it out.
Raise your alibi, spread your wings, it's time to fly. Man, the struggle ain't no lie, but they just don't know that. Now it's time to rise, break the blocks before the sky. Got no time for compromise, ain't no reason to look back. Open up your eyes, cause Elam's on the rise.
mind, ain't no reason to hold back.
Just touch your fingers through the past, hold on tight but lose his grasp. 10-year-old and left to stand, falling victim to a man who ripped him under and took a hand. Taking her back and slipping slow, everybody's letting go and asking questions no one knows. Watching armies bomb my home, stripping away that debt I own. Cheered up nation, junk side on, cause I die for freedom, need them to show. Rise up strong, a mind full of anger, never back down to the bone of the tiger. Everybody tries to fly, I go higher, I go higher.
Tell my resident, yo, we are resident. We ain't free, yes, so we're still fettin'. And they hatin' when we sullin'. Taking over the streets, yo, you're frontin'. Why should we stop? Give us one reason, one inside out. We are still beautiful, see the fool we pivot. Yeah, it's Elon, give us back our rights to freedom.
Do you see him? Same old story. Still as I don't know how would it go. I'm in my brother, what's up, what a show. What ain't no more? The words will soar. Fly with pride of one day. Own the lights are right. The past and show. Raise your hands and tie your mind.
Raise your hand, oh, spread your wings. It's time to fly, man. The struggle ain't no lie, but they just don't know that. Now it's time to rise. Break the blocks before the sky. Got no time for compromise. Ain't no reason to look back. Open up your eyes, cause Elam's on the rise. Independence while we fight. And y'all better know that. Now it's time to ride. Freedom's on our mind, ain't no reason to hold back.
Running through time, but the clock stuck still. Wise hat towers continue to be killed. Mothers and fathers continue to be drilled. Fight to defeat freedom, cause freedom is my will. Bombs struck eyes and it's heavy on my neck. Pierced through the sky and the lion's breath. No compromise, I'm bringing SLA death. Tell you what it is and leave your life in a mess.
I'm all uprising, I'm front line in our urban flag is still rising. So I won't give up now, just keep rising. Innocent lies, war with our eyes. Killing time for the bounce of skies. This is why there are no hides. This is definitely your everyday life. Time to rise up from here. No more what we live in fear. It's now or never, is it clear? All my time will do you here.
Rise up, rise to the call. Cause when it's all over, some aluminum will be born.
Raise your head up high, spread your wings, it's time to fly. Man, the struggle ain't no lie, but they just don't know that. Now it's time to rise, break the blocks before the sky. Got no time for compromise, ain't no reason to look back. Open up your eyes, cause Elam's on the rise. Independence while we fight, and y'all better know that. Now it's time to ride, after all we still survive. Freedom's on our mind, ain't no reason to hold back.
Rise up,
now or never,
for my people.
WikiLeaks and the Imperial Press. The release of some 70,000 plus files from the Afghanistan war has been treated by most corporate media as, at best, a minor irritant, and worst, an act of treason. The instincts expressed by these outlets betrays the same mindset that whipped the nation to war in the aftermath of 9/11. Media as servant of presidential power, and media as servant of the empire and the defense industries. Julian Assange of WikiLeaks has been lashed for not caring sufficiently for U.S. soldiers or secret informants in Afghanistan. His other offense? Counting the deaths of Afghan civilians killed by U.S. troops. For most of the media, that's a no-no. That's what the imperial media sounds like. As it stands, American corporate media is fast becoming a vanishing breed. For less and less people watch TV news or read newspapers. Furthermore, young people are leading this trend. According to some reports, the average U.S. newspaper loses 10% of its readership every year. While technology undoubtedly plays some role in this process, the lack of trust must also be a factor. Their flag waving and martial music led the nation into disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan. When an outfit like WikiLeaks comes along with raw data from the battlefield and secret files, the corporate media seems superfluous. And now, like underfed pit bulls, they attack WikiLeaks for not playing their imperial game. They're barking, but WikiLeaks is biting. From death row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal. Before BP. BP didn't begin as BP. Indeed, it didn't begin as British Petroleum. In 1908, it was known as the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and it exploited Iranian natural resources and labor ruthlessly. Majority shares in the company were owned by the British government, and Iran offered a rich yield for the company. In 1947, for example, the company pulled in after-tax profits of £40 million, while Iran received a mere £7 million. The average Iranian worker housed in huts formed by rusted, hammered oil cans, lived in desolate oil towns and earned about 50 cents a day. One observer from Iran's Petroleum Institute described one such shanty town, Kaghazabad, as a place where, quote, in every crevice hung the foul sulfurous stench of burning oil, unquote. Instead of streets, narrow alleyways existed, which the describer called emporiums. Rats. He said the town was so desolate that there was not a single tree. Is there any wonder that the government of Mohammad Mossadegh wanted to nationalize the country's oil wealth, or that the CIA and Britain's MI5 assured his ouster and imposed the Shah? BP plundered the country, making money hand over fist. Now they're plundering American resources, and the chickens have indeed come home to roost. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
I man say, justice over law. Truth is always right, yet some have to pay a price. Victimized and brutalized, give your life a sacrifice. Mumia Abu Jamal, speak about the truth he knows.
That was Free Mumia Abu Jamal by Aymara. So tomorrow, the case of Mumia Abu Jamal will be back in the Third Circuit Court of Appeal in Pennsylvania, where they're looking to reimpose the death penalty in his case. All across North America, people will be protesting, including here in Toronto. You can protest at the U.S. Consulate, which is between Dundas and Queen at 360 University Avenue. Check that out tomorrow, 6 p.m. here in Toronto. For more information, you check out basicsnews.ca. And we got, Kirti has some more information on some local community events that's happening. You're good.
Yeah. So if you guys have nothing much to do on Saturday, something you should check out is this place called Not By Our Tears. It's basically depicting the plight of Tamil people after the war. Written by Charon, presented by Asylum Theater Group. You can check out www.asylumtheater.ca for more information. Again, that's happening on Saturday, November the 13th. There are two shows, one starting at 4:30 p.m., another at 8 p.m. at UFT Robert Gill Theater. I believe you can also find it on Facebook. Just type in Not By Our Tears, and yeah, you should be able to get more information. Check it out. Yeah.
I hear this play has actually received a lot of critical acclaim.
Definitely.
Around North America. It's been touring.
Yes, it's been touring, and it's got back to Toronto, so definitely check it out. I've heard some good reviews, so it should be pretty good, you know?
For real, check that out. So Radio Basics, we're out for the week. I'm Steve. I'm here with Kirti. New Radio Basics host is going to be holding it down with us from now on. And we're going to take you out with another commentary or two from Mumia Abu-Jamal. Be sure to check out that rally tomorrow. And if you can't make it and you're not too familiar with the case of Mumia, just go check out that information, man. Get up to date on what's happened with that brother, because the attacks that have been made against him are attacks that are made against people struggling for justice everywhere. We know that from listening to his commentaries that this brother is struggling for the people. He is a voice of the voiceless. So check him out, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and be sure to check out that rally tomorrow if you're downtown. Much love, Toronto. Radio Basics, we're out.
Tea parties, the politics of fear. For many, if not most, of the people who are active in the Tea Party movement, they are reacting to the fall of the American economy. They see vast home foreclosures, factory closings, the loss of jobs, and the resultant loss of pay across a wide spectrum of the working class, and they're afraid, very afraid. It's been said that money is the mother's milk of politics, and while that's true, it's also true that fear is powerful currency in the hands of politicians. And once you add media, it's political TNT. It doesn't really matter who's feared. Fear do the trick. For many of them, Mexican immigration is the bubble into which the fear of the foreigner, lost jobs, crime, and even contagion come together with explosive power, and politicians are riding it like broncos. Obama, as a darker man with an exotic name and African origins, also attracts a good slice of that fear. Few of them see that Clinton-era globalization policies gutted key industries as middle-class jobs were flushed to the global south and then to the east to ensure higher returns to investors and corporate owners and managers. Jobs gone to low-wage countries forever. It used to be a man or woman, black, white, or Latino, could get a job at a car factory like GM with a high school diploma that paid middle-class family-raising wages. Those days are passing into the rear-view mirror. Now, college graduates feel lucky to get any job, even an internship. The Tea Party, although funded by rich families, does not target the corporate and economic forces which created their present nightmares. They bellow about lower corporate taxes and the shrinkage of government, ignoring the simple fact that the U.S. pays almost half the corporate tax rate of most industrial nations, or that the U.S. population has doubled between 1950 and 2000. Their fears, to say the least, are misdirected. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.